ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's one of Australia's most baffling unsolved missing persons cases. In 2007, four people, including a five-year-old girl, vanished in Western Australia amid rumours of bizarre behaviour, cults and long-hidden secrets.
Yep, we're trying to track them down.
I'm Dominique Bayens and I've been investigating for the new season of Expanse, The Nan Up 4. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The panopticon was this idea developed by the utilitarian English philosopher and social reformer Jeremy Bentham. It was a prison design. So think of a tower at the centre of a jail with a guard, all-seeing and all-knowing, looking out over inmates who can't see them. Now, why does the internationally acclaimed scientist and climate action advocate Tim Flannery think we should reimagine Bentham's panopticon for modern times?
We're still looking at the wrong end of the panopticon. You go into the streets of Melbourne tonight, you'll find who's being pulled off the street? Homeless people. People who manifestly have nothing. The wealthy, the people who don't pay their tax, they're free to walk about. We need to turn the panopticon around.
He's a paleontologist, prolific author of over a dozen popular books about science, climate change, his research in PNG and much more. He served as inaugural head of the former Australian Climate Commission and then the Climate Council, and he was Australian of the Year. And Tim Flannery's next book, written with his daughter Emma, is called A Brief History of Climate Folly. Hello, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you Big Ideas, ABC Radio National's live event show, and the stage we are heading to today with the Now or Never Festival. Melbourne's annual Festival of Arts, Ideas, Sound and Technology is at RMIT University, where Tim is a professor of practice working with what's called the Planetary Civics Inquiry Project. And by the way, you can hear more about that on a recent episode of the Philosopher's Zone podcast, as it happens. Tim is joining my colleague Hilary Harper today for a philosophical and a hopeful conversation about change and possibility.
I was going back to Here on Earth, your book from 2010 recently, just to kind of compare and contrast where you were at then with the things that you've been writing and speaking about lately. And you say in that book that the window for action on climate was narrowing. Where are we at now?
Well, sadly, we're committed to a degree of climate change that will be uncomfortable. But that's not the end of the story, because we still have the opportunity to avoid much more catastrophic climate change. So it's a struggle we have to continue with, but it's a manifestation of a deeper problem, I think, climate. It's, if we'd really wanted to, we could have addressed this 20 years ago. We had the science, we had the technology, although it needed obviously building. What we lacked was the will. So why did we lack that will? That's the question that keeps on coming back to me as I look back on my career.
Well, and it's about, as you've said many times before, how we work together, isn't it? How well are we working together at the moment?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Think about the rise of Donald Trump, right? Didn't come out of nowhere. We saw that coming. Why did 52% of voting Americans vote for him, at the last election? When the truth is we're not working together, I think, because we are losing the battle for coherence. And why are we losing the battle for social coherence? Why are we dividing into tribes? And I think it is because the privileged and powerful want us that way. So, once people unite with a common view and a common determination, anything is possible. But while we remain divided between black and white, between male and female, between every division you want to think about, we are easy to control. And we have allowed ourselves to fall into that trap as a society, I think.
There's a cartoon I love and despair about as well, from before Trump's first election, and it shows a field of sheep with a billboard on one side that says, "I am going to eat you," and it's a wolf. And the sheep says, "I like him. He tells it like it is. See in that the little microcosm of what's happening in some places around the world, the anxiety about what is going to be in the future, the uncertainty, the need for a strong leader to come through. Mm. What do we do about that as individuals?
Look, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know which way it's going to go, but I have a strong internal conviction that this last paroxysm of the patriarchy that we're seeing in Donald Trump cannot sustain itself, that in fact another vision will have to take its place. And I've long been a Benthamite. Now, most people won't know what I'm talking about out there with a Benthamite, but it's a follower of Jeremy Bentham. He was a philosopher from the 1780s and thereabouts in Britain. He decided to have himself stuffed when he died. And you can go and see him at City University, the University College London, whenever you want. And I always, when I'm in London, go and visit him because he was the man who gave me the key to a truly wonderful future. He was the first person who really articulated the idea that it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, whether you're black or white, we are all equal and we need to be treated as equal under the law. And there's a whole lot of things that followed on from that, including his views about sex and about politics, which were very, very important.
Well, and revolutionary at the time, his ideas about sexuality. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, he was. He just said, you know, look, for most people in Britain at that time, back 250 years ago, life was pretty miserable. There was a lot of disease, it was uncertain, there was a huge amount of poverty. He said, why can't we be generous enough to let these people just enjoy sex? It's one of the great balms of the human condition. So why do we hedge it around with all of these kind of precautions and labelling it as sinful and all the rest? Why not just let people enjoy it? It's the one thing we can give them free that would improve their lives, you know? And it doesn't matter, he said, whether it's a man with a man or a woman with a woman or a man with a woman or whatever. As long as there's no victim, as long as there's no damage, why not let them just do what they want? And that was, of course, a radical idea at the time. Some parts of it so radical he couldn't publish them. He actually wrote them but didn't publish them. But, you know, his ideas were so influential, particularly even on our Australian society.
Well, I mean, I hope obviously that flowed from that he was up for collective child rearing and a radical reshaping of the male-female relations in heterosexual relationships. Obviously, there's a bit more involved there.
If there's no victim, there's no crime. That's his view. It doesn't matter. You can live in a collective if you want with children. It's no concern to anyone but you. As long as there's no victim, there's no crime. So why not live that way?
Yeah.
Look, he had some other ideas. I mean, utilitarianism is perhaps his greatest gift to the modern world, you know, the idea that we should strive for the greatest good for the greatest number. Mm-hmm. And if we were strictly utilitarian, someone would have shot Donald Trump years ago, you know, because they think, yes, the world will be better. But what people fail to understand is that when Bentham laid out that utilitarianism, it was within the context of a deep humanism. So the rules around humanism and respect for each other underpin that concept of utilitarianism, and we cannot get rid of people just because we disagree with them or dislike them, but we have to, as we formulate policy, strive for that idea of the greatest good for the greatest number, with everything from taxation to political systems to whatever else you want to think about.
When I'm reading your writing, I often think about the multiple layers that we need to work on, the local, the national, the global, the planetary and atmospheric, the interstellar even, to fix the problems that face us. Where do we get if we take some of Jeremy Bentham's political and economic ideas and apply them worldwide?
Well, let's take our own society as a great example. So Jeremy Bentham inspired a number of people to radical action. So in the 19th century in Britain, there was a group called the Chartists who were asking government to sign on to six principles, you know, representation in government, you know, employment, all the rest of those sort of things. And they were seen as so radical, some were shot by the military, others were transported to Australia. The ones that were transported to Australia, and there were some of the few people who could read and write in the colony at any kind of adequate level, you know, and many of them, or several of them, ended up as government secretaries. So the governor of the colony would appoint them. And about the time when Britain was suggesting to the Australian colonies that they have elections, who was in charge of these elections? It was Bentham's disciples. So that, you know, the fact that we have, you know, one vote, one value, very strictly policed in Australia. The fact that we have voting, which is what you call it, when you, no one else can see what you're doing, you know, that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Private voting.
You know, all of those
secret
sort of
ballot.
Things.
Thank you.
We didn't quite get in Australia women voting until later, but Bentham would have insisted women vote. But by the 1880s in South Australia, we had women voting. So there was a whole lot of stuff he put in place that we are the beneficiaries of today. So, you know, the US, because it was independent before Bentham's ideas really spread, there's no Benthamite philosophy there. You know, they don't have an electoral commission. They don't have a strong commitment to one vote, one value. And none of that, it's implemented. So,
well, as you said, I mean, some ideas, the time is not ready for them, and Bentham could not talk about some of the things that he believed in. Now, things like, at least, you know, people paying lip service to equality between the sexes, equality of sexuality and other kinds of diversity in some places in the world are accepted. What are the things that we're not seeing that perhaps Bentham could help us with?
Well, one of his ideas that I love, because I'm an anarchist really as well as a Benthamite, but I love turning on its head, is his sense of the panopticon. So he invented a prison system for surveilling the no-gooders in our society in a way that would cause them to self-reform, you know, because they knew they were being watched all the time, they would self-regulate, right? I think he got it all perfectly right, except for the fact that he was looking through the wrong end of the panopticon. We don't need to worry about the poor people. We need to worry about the powerful, right? They need to be in our panopticon. We need to know everything they do. We need to understand the flows of money between them. That's where the panopticon can really play a role. And we have the tools, thanks to Bentham, to do that. We have a taxation system, an electoral system, and regulations that all help us do that, but yet we fail to do it because we're still looking at the wrong end of the panopticon. You go into the streets of Melbourne tonight, you'll find who's being pulled off the street? Homeless people. People who manifestly have nothing and have never stolen anything because they have nothing. The wealthy, the people who don't pay their tax, they're free to walk about.
Yeah,
we need to turn the panopticon around.
Because the panopticon was built on the idea that if people thought they might be being watched at any time of the day or night, they would behave better just in case.
Exactly.
But it was backed up with the threat of force. You know, if you weren't behaving and they were watching, then you got punished.
Yes.
So do we need to get a bit better at our punishment systems, having justice seen to be done?
Well, we do. And I think putting people in jail doesn't do the job. If it was up to me, I would have an anti-ANZAC Day march. So 6 months after the ANZAC Day march, I'd have, for the worst offenders, those who've, you know, stolen from old ladies and whatever else and done things that are destructive to society, they'd have to walk through the streets with a sign around them saying, I defrauded old Mrs. Jones, you know, or I took money from the super fund, you know, that everyone had contributed to or whatever, right? Or I didn't pay my tax. Those sort of things, they're the real crimes that impoverish us all and which never get recognised. And that idea of social embarrassment is really important, I think, and it lets us know where the real crimes lie.
I was thinking how that idea of public shaming relies on a very solid shared understanding of what is right and wrong and what are the acceptable standards of behaviour in a society. Do you think we're there?
Well, people are born with a sense of that. It can be distorted. It can be self-interest can be justified by all kind of crazy means of thought. But at the end of the day, we need to say things like paying tax is a privilege, right? It's something we should be accept as being not just right, but enormously beneficial, you know? So we need to rethink the way as a society we work. And why is all of this important? Because we need to create the cohesion that's required to solve the problems, right? While we are all fighting among ourselves about whether we're male, female, black, white, whatever it is, the fossil fuel industry is just running away with the world, you know?
Well, and you wrote an essay recently for The Monthly in which you said some really interesting things. And one of them was that you do believe that democracy will prevail, even in, you know, a fairly Trumpian era. In various parts of the world, people are subscribing to the views that he's putting out. Why are you so hopeful?
Look, I'm a paleontologist by training, so I always take the long view. And if I think back on my childhood, can I tell you, when I was at university, I wasn't all that aware of politics. And I remember taking a young lady out to dinner one evening. I'd spent all of the money I had on a bottle of Matus Rosé, which back in the day was really, really important, right?
Yes.
It was expensive. And she almost threw it back in my face. She said, this was grown under Salazar, the great dictator of Portugal, you know, who was still in power at the time, right? He and Franco. And so, you know, the world I grew up in had fascists in Western Europe. All of Eastern Europe was under communism, Stalinist, you know, kind of communism. And democracy was just this fragile thing in Europe. Look at it today. Look where we are today. You know, the forgers of the European Union understood the power of working together. They understood the Benthamite principles that are necessary, the generosity that's necessary to spread that prosperity. And they have been triumphant. They've been successful. I mean, it's interesting to compare Trump with the EU, right? Trump wants to buy Greenland. Half of Eastern Europe is rolling up to join. They want to join the EU, right? They don't have to be bought. They understand that that is the kind of society they want to live in.
On Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, ABC Radio National's Hilary Harper is on the stage today with scientist, popular author, climate action optimist, and as you've heard, Jeremy Bentham philosophy fanboy, Tim Flannery. Coming up, how Tim finds connection with his critics. And you can share this conversation with your friends. Just look for Big Ideas on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you said you take the long view and that's why you're optimistic, I was thinking, how long? Like crashing into the sun long? Like don't have to worry about it anymore? But you've also written that humans are actually integral to our planetary systems. We're not an irritant. We're not something we can do without, are we?
We are the only way the Earth knows itself. So
that sounds pretty arrogant.
Well, we are. We're the only ones with a concept of this thing called Gaia, you know? And that's because, you know, for better or for worse, evolution gave rise to this enormous and powerful brain that can do all of this stuff. And, you know, I've always worked with a kind of an idea that information organises matter. And that's true if you go back to basic physics. The information that's contained in those shells of electrons and stuff is what builds the universe out. And the most powerful information processing system that exists in the known universe is between our ears. So we are, I think, an important part of the destiny of this whole system. So I really strongly think that we, if not us, then another species will come after us. We'll do the job that is preordained, really, maybe, or destined by the evolutionary process.
That's an interesting way to think about the evolutionary process. It sounds a little bit like, you know, the Christian idea of predestination, that you're on a path and the universe has a plan.
I think that's right. And that's not very scientific, but it feels to me like what is right. I can't justify it beyond that axiom that information organises matter. But when I think about what's at stake with our civilization, it isn't just, you know, us. It is the planet knowing itself, ultimately the universe knowing itself is at stake. And it's only if we can cooperate together, we can subdue our kind of individual egos in a way and see, no, it's not I that's important, it's we, it's us.
When we think about collective knowledge, you know, there are some people that argue that it's a kind of constant, slightly bumpy upward trajectory. And there are others like, you know, thousands of years ago, there were these peaks of knowledge that are completely lost now, you know, ancient Babylon, you know, Chinese empires that kind of waxes and wanes, the medieval period, and the Dark Ages. Yeah. What's your thought? Are we on a kind of constant upward trend or are we at risk of losing a lot of that knowledge?
Well, you know, I think we're at risk of losing that knowledge for sure. But we are now at a point where we are a global civilization. So does the whole globe crash or does it not? That's the question we're looking at right now.
Well, and writers like Sarah Wilson have been very vocal lately and others talking about what she calls collapsologie in French. It's like it's a very French intellectual term. But, you know, that idea that our economic systems and social systems are quite close to collapse. Do you think that's true and also a useful way to approach things, if we're getting utilitarian about it?
Look, I think if you're thinking about a system that takes, you know, a third of the energy that plants capture from the sun, of course it's walking a tightrope, you know. It's a bit like our brain, you know. Our brain weighs 1% of our body mass and takes 20% of the energy we take in. You know, it's expensive, it's awkward, it's greedy, it's selfish, but, you know, and it's always on that tightrope. But somehow it survives. Well, in my case, for 69 years, but, you know, won't survive forever, but collectively will go on, I think. And I do think that people respond very to kindness, to consideration, to a sense of inclusion, you know, and I do believe that's a massively powerful force in human society. So the arrogant selfishness of the Trumps of the world is, it's just not appealing to a lot of people.
There was a beautiful illustration of the kind of competing ideas of competition and collaboration within evolution in your book Here on Earth. Can you tell us a bit about Daisy World for those not familiar with the concept?
Yeah, sure. This was a computer program written by James Lovelock, and it was just based on two kinds of daisies, a yellow one and a black one. And a black daisy will obviously absorb heat, and the yellow daisy reflects sunlight and therefore cools the planet. So he just ran the program to see what would happen over time, and it ended up in a sort of a balance, you know, one did not overwhelm the other. And in a way, I guess life is always seeking that balance, yeah? We need those conditions that suit life, and the planet has been very good at providing them ever since life arose.
But that example really flew in the face of how people thought of evolution in some circles, didn't it? You know, people thought of it as that social Darwinist idea, the survival of the strongest and perhaps meanest, instead of, you know, a system that gradually kind of comes into balance and works for the good of both on a species level.
Well, that's the incredible... It's hard for me to believe that some people think that nature's red in tooth and claw and that's how evolution works. It just clearly isn't. Just look at our bodies. We're a collective of tens of thousands of different organisms. I mean, every cell within us actually is composed of two quite distinct organisms, the mitochondria derived from one and the rest of the cell from another. We're all about cooperation and collaboration. We can't exist by ourselves. So I don't know where this idea comes from, or, you know, that somehow nature red in tooth and claw, you know, Nazism, eugenics, all that stuff has any legs. None of it stands up to scrutiny. It's a psychopathy is what it is.
Yeah, we'd be substantially less weighty without our gut microbiome, for starters.
Well, and less healthy, yes. Maybe not even alive.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Let's do an experiment. You are running a course on leadership, climate change and the Pacific with RMIT in your new position. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And that looks at things like energy sovereignty and renewables, but also social cohesion and adaptation. Yeah. Where do you feel we are with the mix between mitigation and adaptation right now? Because there are some like Clive Hamilton who have come out and said, it's too late for mitigation of various kinds. Like we should do both, but we should really turn our attention to adaptation now.
Well, you know, there's a lot at stake, yeah? If we keep polluting at the level we are, we could end up in a world that's 1,000 parts per million CO2, yeah? So at the moment we're about 430 parts per million. The last time things were had that concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere was 5 million years ago. We know what that world looks like. 1,000 million is a different world, yeah? So we have to do two things at once. We have to adapt and we have to mitigate. And mitigation is not that difficult. If the fossil fuel industry would let us do it, we would have it done very quickly. When I say quickly, within a decade or two perhaps, if we got on a war footing and did it, we could do it. Australia's doing very well, incidentally. You know, we'll know in the next week or two what the targets are, but you can see the progress that's being made, and it's generally heading in the right direction. I'm kind of hopeful that by, you know, 2035, the electricity sector will be completely decarbonised. We will have made great progress with transport. And the industrial emissions will be slowly coming under control.
Yeah, I was really heartened to read some of the things you've written lately. You know, 44% of our electricity comes from wind, solar, batteries and hydro. And you're saying, you know, give it another 3 years or so.
Yeah.
What about the government? I know you've written that you thought the last election was the last climate election. Yeah. Is the government showing signs of heading in that three-year direction?
Well, let me just unpack why I think this is the last climate election. And that's because at the moment, we've got about 45% of our electricity coming from renewable sources. When I was climate commissioner, it was 10%. Right? So it's growing. We have targets that are eminently achievable. It'll take us to 82% by 2030. So the next election will be about 2028. By then, we'll be 70% plus, right? So there won't be much to argue over. Right, with the last fraction of fossil fuel use is not going to be worth the industry spending hundreds of millions of dollars on to defend, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why I think it's going to be the last climate election.
You were also talking about, you know, there's the big fancy kind of geoengineering solutions, some of which are a little bit frightening and might have unintended consequences. There's, you know, just reducing carbon, which is obviously something that, you know, a lot of countries are very, very keen to do. And then you also talked about the third way, things like reforestation, testing out things like biochar and seaweed farming, basically whatever looked like it might be useful. Yeah. Is the government doing those things or just the kind of big sexy things?
The government's not paying enough attention to that stuff. And I've got to frame this in terms of scale, right? So this is at the moment, as a globe, we emit about 50 billion tonnes of CO2 a year in round figures, you know, and people argue around the edges, but it's somewhere between 40 and 60, right? In terms of drawdown, the benefits we get from protecting forests and regrowing forests mostly, with a little bit of, you know, sequestration in rocks and other things thrown in, is about 2 billion tonnes. So we're 50 going up, 2 going in through forests, right? So people think we can increase that to 3, right? But it's not going to become 50 in the perhaps ever, right? There's just the capacity to soak that amount in is not there. So therefore, people are looking at geoengineering. This is technologies like putting sulfur into the atmosphere, particularly over the poles, to cool the planet and let the ice regrow. And then it's more reflective and then we'll be on a more sustainable trajectory maybe. But the unintended consequences of those technologies are not well thought through and not understood. So it's a massive risk, right? What makes them tempting, of course, is that they're cheap, they're instant, put the Band-Aid on, forget about the festering underneath and do it. And it's within the remit of a single wealthy individual to do that. You know, there's no global treaty dealing with it. You know what you've got to do if you want to start geoengineering in the US? You've just got to post 2 weeks' notice that you're going to do it with NOAA. Yeah.
That's really disturbing.
Yeah, it is. And the scientists are ignoring it too. If there's any scientists out there, I plead with you, do the modelling to work out what, you know, sulphur distributed through aircraft across the poles, what it really means.
Mm. It's really interesting talking to you because I feel like there is so much room for hope. You know, there is so much that is being done. We are getting towards particular targets a bit further away from some others. What do you think is going on with the levels of apathy or fatalism, I guess is probably another term, in some parts of our society? Like there are some people I talk to who are like, it's just too much. It's too tiring. I don't think it's going to happen. The collapsology people are like, let's shelve it and start planting veggies and doing without the internet.
It's very convenient giving up. But really, you know, you can rest, you can have a break, right? Not think about it. So I understand the human motivation for doing that. But the fact is we can never afford to give up with this, you know. It's like this is a war for our survival, you know. We can't give up. And we are winning battle after battle. We're not winning them all, but we're winning a lot, largely due to China, you know. China's just done this incredible vault face now and they've built the manufactories that can turn the whole world green, you know. So that's a massive benefit. So I'd say don't give up, don't relax. Take a break if you need, but, you know, join the fight again.
The other question that occurred to me about that was how much do you think the fossil fuel industry is pushing that message of like, let's not worry about it anymore? You know, either let's not worry about it because it's not a problem or let's not worry about it, there's nothing you can do.
I think they've been far more sophisticated than that. You know, what they've done is got behind this right-wing view of fostering tribes, right? So every time we make a step forward, and you'll remember the gay marriage debate in Australia, right? Massively opposed by the right. Why would they really care about gay marriage, right? I don't think they did. But what they saw was an opportunity to create division in society, right? And with every one of these things, this is what they do, LGBTQI, exactly the same. They'll pick on something, they'll find something within it that can divide, even if it just divides a few of us off, they'll relentlessly go after it so that we can never stand united against them. And that is the true evil of what they do.
So
because it not only maintains their profit and their position of power, it degrades our capacity as a society to thrive.
So the idea then is to try and make connections even across seeming political or social divides in order to stymie those attempts to divide us on whatever issue.
Look, this is we are in a game of very poorly refereed football, right? It's what it is. And we've got possession of the ball. China's done all of this work. But the opposition are tripping us, kicking us in the nuts, doing every high tackles, everything, right? And the last thing we should do is attack them, because that will take our eye off the ball. We just need to win. We need to get the ball between those goalposts, you know, and that's our job. So I would ignore them, keep your eye on the goal, which is creating a cohesive society that can regulate the powerful as we require and give people the dignity that we all need. Jeremy Bentham said it all 2.5 centuries ago, you know.
Yeah.
If we can listen to that voice again. And of course, long before Bentham, people like Jesus said the same thing. It's all about love. Love your neighbour, you know. It's about acceptance. It doesn't matter whether someone's a prostitute or a tax collector. It's about acceptance.
If you get nailed to a cross.
Yeah. It is that. So those messages are very, very powerful. And, of course, the oligarchs, the powerful, have always hated them and tried to pervert them.
I loved that you wrote in your essay, you know, we need a revolution, basically, against the oligarchs. What is your manifesto? Where's your 10-point plan?
It's all Jeremy Bentham. It's just love one another, respect one another, stand united. Be proud of the role we play in this incredible society that we're privileged enough to live in. You know, oppose what is morally wrong. Morally wrong is really those who seek to exert their authority over others where there is no victim, right, for their own benefit.
Scientist, author, environmentalist Professor Tim Flannery is the big thinker on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas today, and he's in conversation with Hilary Harper.
The idea of morality is really interesting, isn't it? Because I feel like there's quite a tussle over what is the right thing to do in Australia at the moment, and there's very different opinions, for example, when it comes to how we treat people who think differently from us, whether we should shout them down, whether we should stop them speaking at writers' festivals, let them speak at writers' festivals but say unpopular things. Where do you stand on that?
Well, it's all about respect for me, respect for people. And we'll never win by opposing people. All we're doing is creating another tribe. We're then the lefties, the greenies, you know, whatever. You know, I learned some real lessons when I was climate commissioner. You know, it was a tough job. I had to get out there and speak to people who disagreed with me, right? And I remember one occasion where I was out at Young, and the mayor was a shearer. Some of the other members of the local council were very anti-renewables. Anyway, I went to speak with them, and one bloke just stood up, one councillor stood up and harangued me for 10 minutes about the horrors of wind farms and all the rest of it, right? Didn't say anything because it was their day to do what they needed to. But at morning tea, I went up to him and found him and just said, look, I can have a chat to you. You know, it was respect your views. I disagree with them, but respect them. So what do you do around town? And he said, I'm a musician. And I said, oh, that's interesting. To play, you know, what instrument do you play? And he said, I play the piano accordion. And just by coincidence, I'd had my first piano accordion lesson 3 weeks earlier. And I said, would you believe it? I've just had my first piano accordion lesson. And he said, what kind of accordion have you got? I said, I've got a Honan. And he said, oh, Honan? Great. We hit it off. He said, come back to Young. You're always welcome. We can disagree, but you're always welcome to come and have a chat, you know. And it's that building respect with people you disagree with is the hardest thing, but it is absolutely necessary to have a civil society and have a proper dialogue. And you have to be ready to change your mind if people can persuade you if you want other people to open their minds to your thoughts.
I mean, that is a very admirable thing to say. But when it comes to climate change, I guess some people feel, look, this is such a huge issue and I think that the science is so clear that I do not want my mind changed. Where's the nuance there for you?
Well, you won't change your mind unless the facts change, right? And if someone could demonstrate to me that climate change or that CO2 was not affecting, temperature, for example, in a cohesive scientific way, I'd have to agree. But no one has yet offered that proof. So, you know, this is where we can have a civil dialogue about this.
So in terms of having your mind changed in a conversation with any given climate skeptic,
yeah,
that seems unlikely. But you
for those basics, but maybe someone will come up with something. I've always got my mind open to the possibility. It's like, you know, Newton, the law of gravity, right? It's not really a law because any day I might drop an apple and it'll go up. I can't say it won't, right? So, yeah. But anyway.
Yeah, the physicist might.
Yeah. So, but look, can I just tell you one other story? So there's the basic climate science, right? But then there's everything around it. And I remember going out to Central Queensland to the coal fields talking about climate change and very hostile reception for a lot of people, you know, some people being rude and whatever else. And there was one bloke who was about 6'6" and built like a brick shit house, you know, and I could see the coal dust in his skin, right? And after my 15 minutes of speaking, I asked for questions and whose hand went up first? This bloke, right? And I thought, oh, well, we'll batten down the hatches for this. But he said to me, he said, I was a farmer before I was a coal miner. And he said, I understand now from what you've said why I went broke. It was the climate change affecting the seasons and things. He said, but I've got two daughters and a family and I have to, you know, I've had to go and work in the mines. He said, can you tell me, am I doing the right thing? It was an incredible moment where, again, you're on the spot. And, of course, I had to say, yes, you are. I wish government had given you better options, but your family has to come first. So it's things like that where you've got to just empathise, think and be flexible, you know, around respecting other people.
Well, it sounds like too that what you're open to is hearing what's underneath people's arguments and their anxieties and fears. You know, you're hearing what's actually going on for them rather than their, you know, dot by dot understanding of climate science.
Well, exactly. And that bloke at the piano accordionist from young, I realised his role in council and probably in his family has been a grumpy old, crazy old uncle who'd say things at Christmas dinner and everyone would be outraged and that's how he got off. It was his thing, you know. So you've got to understand people a bit too to make progress.
Yeah. I grew up in country Victoria and every town needs to have at least one eccentric.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
how it works.
Yeah, often on council.
Yes, that's how they get there. But, I mean, you made the point too with the coal miner story about how, you know, often it's the overarching material circumstances of people's lives, not these little individual choices. But do you feel there's a sense in Australia at the moment that a lot of focus and judgment and scrutiny gets put onto our individual choices? It's like, are you driving an electric car?
Yeah,
you know, are you
of
recycling?
Course.
How useful is that?
Not useful at all.
Yes.
It's not useful at all. It tends to create tribes, right? And then we'll create a tribe. There'll be an EV driving tribe and there'll be a petrol car driving tribe and the petrol car driving tribe will just dig in and say, no, we're right. We can't, that's not the world we want to have, right? So I think we not to be judgmental, to ask questions, to make suggestions, to be open to, you know, to a discussion, that's great. But not judging other people on that basis because there may be a whole lot of reasons why they're not yet there ready to buy an EV.
Well, yeah. Oh, God. I remember having a discussion once with someone about recycling and they were like, I am a single parent who works. Yeah. I don't have time to drive my polystyrene to Moonee Ponds or whatever the thing was that you had to do, you know. It's just too hard. But, I mean, if then the material circumstances of people's lives are so important and we have so little individual control over them, do you feel like perhaps instead of tinkering around the edge with the tax system, we might need some kind of larger scale change, economically speaking?
Well, we do. It's all about money at the end of the day. I really truly believe that. And that's why the powerful, they're trying to defend their money. And the pathetic thing is that as you become more dependent on capital, you start to lose your social capital. And I've had a lot to do with some reasonably wealthy people. Thankfully, some of them are immune to this, but many of them, you can go up and talk to them and they say, why is this person being friendly with me? Is it because I'm rich? Because I know I'm not that interesting anyway, but I've got a lot of money, you know. And so that, and there's no social capital. Whereas for others, it's each other that is the greatest resource. You know, that's the way the world should be. That's the way the world's made to be.
I mean, I feel sorry for the rich now, which is makes me uncomfortable. Yeah. But
well, I think we're doing a favour by taxing them, you know, and we could do a better job at that, you know. So if it was up to me, if I was doing it, I'd just say what I'll do is take the electoral roll, choose 100 people at random, so they're a statistically valid sample of the electorate, and say we need you to serve for a period of time, maybe 3 months. We'll pay you to do it. You can call anyone in the nation in front of you to hear what they've got to say about tax-related issues. But at the end of that time, we want you to come up with the basics of a tax code. Who should pay what, right? And that would be a tax system which would resonate with people because it would represent the will of the people as a whole. At the moment, you know, you can't get that. But in a Benthamite world, we could.
So a kind of citizens' tax forum roundtable thing.
No, not really a forum. This is an inquisition, right? This is they're actually tasked with coming up with the goods at the end of the day, and the government will be obligated to take those recommendations and build a tax system that reflects that will of the people.
Yeah, and no one expects the inquisition, so it would be pretty surprising
exactly.
for the politicians.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. It's really interesting that they haven't got you on the productivity roundtable, Tim.
Oh, really? Oh, well, yeah. Isn't it fun? Well, there won't be a Benthamite there. There won't be anyone with a kind of a sense of community there. This special interests tend to reign in those areas. They go to great lengths to get themselves elected to things like that.
Well, we've touched on the idea that, you know, the rich and powerful, the oligarchs, are not invested in our sense of community, not invested in environmental care and custodianship. But you also argue that in your essay for the Monthly that they're out to destroy our sense of fun. What do you mean by that?
Well, they are, because, you know, fun, cohesion, relaxation, a sense of love between people and community, they are the enemy to them, because if people cohere, then they are in danger. You know, and just talking about these people, I'm not saying that they're inherently evil, but they live in a situation that is, it's created its own sense of insecurity, you know. The people who got it right, in my view, were like the old Presbyterian mill owners in 18th century Scotland, you know, deeply religious people who took the Bible literally, who believed it was simply wrong to pay yourself any more than 10 times the amount you paid your poorest paid worker. That was the span of permittable salaries across the company. And those people, because they went to church every Sunday with their, you know, their community, including their workers and others, were able to hold their heads up and do that. That was acceptable. It's not the case today. I mean, people are creating gated communities today because they're in fear of losing the thing that's crippling them.
Were those mill owners safe from the machine breakers, the Luddites, when that came?
Yeah, well, I don't know what they did. Probably would have put the Luddites in jail, those mill owners, but
Presbyterianism maybe, only goes so
maybe
far.
The people who worked in those mills wouldn't have become Luddites, yeah, because they're, you know, and when we think about our position socially, it's always relative. Are you a wealthy person or not? We judge that against others around us. It's not an absolute, you know. It's always relative. So those Presbyterian mill owners had the right idea that to create that sense of equality and cohesion in society, we need to limit one of the seven deadly sins, greed.
When we talk about the oligarchs, perhaps we should explain what you mean. Are you talking about, you know, the incredibly wealthy tech bros that now exert such an influence over our lives, or is it broader than that?
It's broader than that. They come together in uneasy coalitions. So, you know, the tech bros might join with the fossil fuel industry, even though they are opposed at many levels. The thing they have in common is a need to keep society fragmented and prevent them from, you know, joining forces to limit the activities of some of these groups. So I think they are just they're coalitions of convenience across a whole series of interests. And it's kind of sad to see. We need to, you know, we can be better than that as a society and as a people.
Well, when you said, you know, they're against our sense of fun, I had the impression you were talking about the convenient truth that we're now often glued to a screen and that kind of cuts us off from each other and from some ways of forming community. It actually helps foster other forms of community. Is that what you meant, or is it broader as well?
No, it is. It's broader than that. We've somehow become a very censorious society. The fun. Look, my father-in-law was in the audience out there somewhere, and he was telling people at RMIT today that when he was at RMIT in the late 1940s, the students would throw water-filled balloons and flower-filled balloons at each other at the end of term and muck up and do things that were, you know. Yes, we've lost that sense of fun and become so self-policed with so much, I think.
Though some people would argue that's a bit of a blip, the water balloon phase, because, you know, there's this argument that we're descended largely from convicts but also police, and Australia has actually always been really good at policing ourselves and others. How would we wrestle back a sense of fun or create one if it wasn't there?
Oh, God, well, that's a great question. I think we've got to be a bit heretical about it. We have to create that sense of fun, be honest with each other, which is often a great source of fun, you know. But we need the warmth and bonds between us, so when we do that, people understand we're not dissing them, when we're simply having some fun about things.
More street parties.
Yeah. I don't know quite how you recreate that, but I think it's very important that we do.
Well, I mean, people often talk about spending time in nature, not just because it's really good for our mental health, but because it connects people to a landscape that they might not otherwise understand or care about. Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those people who need a bit of time out. I can get back into the fray, you know, and do what I need to do, but I definitely need that time out to somehow reset my emotional balance, you know, to get it right again. I think there's probably a lot of people a bit like that, that that's essential. So, they're really important things, but how do we create a society that gives people the basis? I mean, I see so many people now in the streets who are so stressed over various things, and somehow we've created this society that's our Frankenstein's monster. We need to undo it. We need to understand how to undo it.
What do you think is going on there? I mean, there are real things that we're all stressed about. A lot of us are stressed about climate change. There's the cost of loaves of bread. I feel a bit Benthamite in that sense, that, you know, everything's really expensive if you're poor. But is it also about that we have come to expect more from life than is achievable for a lot of people? Our aspirations are in the wrong spot.
I think people do hanker after a sense of security, which is inevitably false, because at any moment anything can go wrong with any of us, you know. And previous generations were not quite as obsessed with that. They had a greater acceptance of the fragility of life and the fragility of things, and a greater sense of community. And that, you know, I think that increasing individualism, the sort of selfishness of the current trend, works very much against that sense of security, you know, because if you're from a big family or a bigger group, and you know there's children there and whatever, you know, we all know we die because we've seen granddad do it and someone else, and we know there's kids are going to come along, and we somehow accept that that's the world we live in. But in this fragmented society we live in, there's a huge amount of anxiety, particularly around death and security. And they're not, I mean, security's not really, it's an illusion by and large, you know. I think for the long term it is. It's because we can die of a heart attack tomorrow. We can try to protect ourselves against it. But there's no point destroying your life by worrying about it.
I was thinking more about, do we all hanker after marble top benchtops, but that's a bigger picture question than answer, and I appreciate that.
Well, exactly, with a marble benchtop, yes. Well, that's the relative thing, eh? Someone's got a marble benchtop and some, and I'm not going to comment on that. that's something that's kind of a bit lower down the order of things. But
How should we deal with the fact that some people conflate scientists, including climate scientists, with like intellectual elites, you know, and they mistrust them?
Yeah.
How do we deal with that? Because that seems quite important in progressing things.
Well, this is another trend in our modern society that's been fomented by the powerful to discredit those who want to, you know, who see something wrong and want to fix it. So, you know, Silent Spring, Rachel Carson was probably the first person who stood up in a big way and faced this full on, faced the blowback from the chemical industry. And so everywhere Rachel went, someone followed her the next day and gave a talk about how great the chemical industry was to the same kind of audience as far as they could get it, you know. And I guess the world I grew up in, there was a much greater respect for knowledge. So the local doctor was someone who you'd respect in a way that we don't seem to respect doctors today, you know. Professors of university were way up there, you know. But all of that has been destroyed to some extent. And I don't think that the industrial efforts to discredit scientists or everything perhaps there's more to it than that. But we are no respecters of expertise in the way we used to be, you know.
I remember that ethos too from growing up in the 70s and 80s in regional Victoria, but I also remember the kind of low-level scoffing that went on about, you know, people in ivory towers and they're just too far away from the real world and they wouldn't know a cow pad if they fell on one and stuff like that. Yeah. And I feel that that's still quite evident, you know, people saying this is so far removed from my actual life and the stresses of it. How can we bridge that? Do we need more connection into the community?
Yes, and it's the way we present as academics that is important. I mean, for me, the heart of being an academic is inquiry. So asking other people, not having the answers, we don't. What we have is the questions as academics, as scientists particularly. I mean, if you're follow Popperian science, you know that we can never know anything. The apple might fall upwards next time we do, you know, we let go of it. But we can disprove things, right? So I think scientists need to re-foster that sense of humility and inquiry and really listen, because you can learn a lot from ordinary people, you know, and their experience.
Yeah. I note that you're not wearing your leather elbow patches today.
I've worked for many, many years in New Guinea, you know, up in the mountains with tribal people. And sometimes they say things that you think as a scientist is so patently ridiculous that you want to laugh, you know. I remember I found a new kind of tree kangaroo. These local people had hunted it. They'd showed it to me. I recognised it as new and I wanted to take a sample back to Australia to describe. And I started asking them questions about it. I said, what does this animal eat? And they said, oh, it eats worms. And I said, I didn't say it, but I thought, this is pretty weird because every other tree kangaroo in the world eats leaves and, you know, vegetation. And I was like, I don't know whether it could find enough worms to eat. But anyway, so I kind of discounted that, almost to the point of barely writing it down, you know. I got back to Australia, opened the sample of the stomach that I'd taken. It was full of worms. But what was really interesting was these were symbiotic worms. So the animal was eating leaves. They were going into the stomach. This species had developed this special symbiosis with these strong-eyelid worms. There was 250,000 of them, individual worms, in the stomach of this thing, so packed you couldn't see the leaf fragments. They were voraciously eating the leaves that the kangaroo ingested. But then as they died, they would go into the intestine and be digested and feed the tree kangaroo. So they were right. And I should have been humble enough to think these are the people who live with these animals every day, you know. They're probably right, but I didn't. As a scientist, I thought I knew better. And that's a great danger.
You're going to do a project where you work with communities in PNG, I understand, as part of your professorship at RMIT.
Yes.
And you're doing this in a kind of decolonising way. So trying to work with local communities and you know, take into account their knowledge. How easy is that to do?
Well, that colonial legacy has been dangerous and incredibly persistent across the Pacific. I talk about the Solomon Islands where I was doing some work in 2017, 2018, and, you know, I hadn't before I started working there, I hadn't really heard about the Anglo-Australian War against the Quayo people, which took place between 1927 and 1928. We sent HMAS Adelaide into their waters off their land and sent an army in to kill them. You know, hundreds of people died. And when you go to those places, for those people, that war is still active. It's never been resolved. There's been no final settlement. And, you know, and it keeps flaring up. So, you know, Malaita was considered a very dangerous place for Europeans to go there because people kept on getting killed. And in 2013, there was a bloke from Melbourne, actually, an accountant, who had his head chopped off there. And I met the man who'd done it when I went to Quayo. And it turned out that he had done it because he'd, young man, fallen asleep, had a dream that his ancestor, grandfather, had come to him and said, "Not enough blood has been paid for my death. You need to go and kill someone." He woke up from the dream, took a bush knife down to the local hospital, waited around until after dark and just beheaded the first person he could find. So the war was still going on for them. So in order to do our work there with that community, we needed to do a reconciliation ceremony about that war. You know, and that took 18 months and a lot of effort, a lot of money to do. But we did it and then got on to community building and so forth. So that colonial legacy is kind of it's really alive in the Pacific in ways it's hard to comprehend until you start really engaging with people.
Well, and when you're doing work on climate mitigation and adaptation, you must feel a sense of urgency. How do you balance that with going, actually, I have to play the long game here. This is going to take patience.
Yeah, exactly. All you can do, you know, we are against very, very powerful forces. I mean, you've seen Trump now take a very active stance against renewables and looking like he's now going to place tariffs on countries that won't buy fossil fuels from the US, you know. So, yes, there's a lot of evil out there in the world. I can't personally do anything about that, but what I can do is work with those communities to create some resilience, you know, and or help create resilience. So with that same community I was talking about where the war was going on, after we developed our community association, they got a grant of $400,000 from the Australian government to look at resilience in agriculture, which was driven largely by women because they were getting more droughts, different seasonality. They needed to develop some ways of food storage that they hadn't done before, and they got a grant to do that. That was fantastic. So that sort of thing happens and is great.
I was thinking specifically when I was thinking about that balance between urgency and patience of doing decolonised work around climate change in Indigenous communities, you know, as a middle-aged white guy going in from a well-funded university, relatively speaking, to do that work. So, yeah, how does that go on the ground? Do you sometimes go, but I want to do this quickly?
No, you can't. It's, you know, and it's their project. It's their society. It's their project. I basically come in with a proposition, you know, and all of these communities, you've got to understand, I've known people for 30 or 40 years where I work in these places, right? So I'm go back, there's a level of trust. And, you know, what I say to them is, look, I've found a pot of money that people outside want to spend on forest protection. You've got some forests. First, do you want to protect them? And if so, how would you like to structure something where, you know, we could protect those forests in a transparent way so the funder can see that? But you get something in return. And you tell me, you know, what you want. And inevitably, you've got to set up a community association with really deep democratic roots into the society, but with a fully accountable sort of committee at the head, which is where there's a, you know, an audit trail, and so they can accept money and in a responsible way from outside funders. So it's responsibility up and responsibility down. And it takes a long time to do that. But once you get it up and running, it's a very, very powerful entity. I've set up, with the communities, a community conservation association in PNG, which has 50,000 members and is going gangbusters. The one in Malaita in the Solomon Islands, it's about 4,000 to 10,000 people. We're just doing one in Indonesian Papua now, so they're kind of exemplars, really, of what we can do. So with the RMIT position, what I hope to do is to grow those, to bring other people into the orbit of those associations and learn from other Melanesians how to do this and then kind of multiply the effect.
So you're doing local community building international community building for planetary goals.
Yeah. It's really, it's about human dignity. I mean, you know, a lot of those people have had a rough time. And we're working in, you know, the one in eastern Indonesia, for example, there was, you know, a military intervention there 6 years ago that resulted in a lot of deaths from local people. You know, the Australian thing in 1927-28 still, you know, rebounding. So it's those disadvantaged communities that I'm trying to focus on.
How much news do you read, Tim, and what kind?
Well, I read across the headlines. I read the BBC, I read the Times, I read the Guardian and the Australian, because I want to know what is common among these. And it's really interesting to do that because, you know, the BBC, the Times, the Guardian all have the same sort of stories. The Australian, it's a totally different world, a parallel universe almost. But it's important to read it so you understand what the power brokers are thinking.
That's really interesting though, isn't it? Because it's got such a small readership compared to the aggregate of all those other things. How influential do you think those voices are that are doing those little ones?
Well, what they do, they have a cascade effect. So they realise that Australia by itself is worth nothing, but then they work in with right-wing shock jocks and populist magazines and newspapers and feed stories down and let the less responsible amplify them and say things that, you know, are not credible, that are lies. But that stir up the populace and into tribes again, trying to fracture us, continuously trying to fracture us into tribes. So that, you know, all of the stories are about something nasty, about someone we don't like or some, you know, liberal so-and-sos or whatever. You know, it's these attempts to destroy our cohesiveness as humans.
Yep. I was thinking about
to destroy the love between us, really.
Yeah, and that sense of common ground, the sense of the points where we can connect.
Yeah.
I was having a discussion with a friend today about the not enormous distance between some groups of people who are into growing their own veggies, being self-sufficient, being off the grid, environmental action, and sovereign citizens, like. There's a little overlap sometimes, but not politically, you know, or not very much politically. And you can see how, you know, if things can go differently, there can be room for dialogue. How would you recommend we do that on a day-to-day level?
Be part of your society. And if someone says something to you that's provocative or something, have a listen and say, oh, yeah, what? Tell me more. What do you think? You know, what's and try to get into some sort of dialogue and, you know, respect and listening. And a bit of fun are all important, you know? And I just think that's what we're lacking. But I'd like to work at it at all levels, from our own society and the people that we know and like or dislike, through to that tax commission, the Inquisition that I would love to see take place.
I love this, public shaming, the Inquisition. This could really go either way.
Well, I was brought up as a Catholic, so I know the tools that work. Jesuits taught me well.
Speaking of that, I remember the Climate Commission, the Climate Council was always very positive in its communications. Yeah. Every communication I would get with them was like, let's focus on the positives, presumably so that we did not freak out and give up. Yeah. Is your optimism a policy or something that kind of wells up organically within you?
No, it's just something organic. I believe, having done that climate commission work for 3 years of going out into the countryside and meeting people who didn't like me, who'd been told lies about me, who didn't believe climate change, I came away from that with a fundamental belief in the goodness of human nature, you know, because in some of those audiences, even though people disagreed with me, if one idiot got up and started shouting and screaming, everyone would turn around and say, shut up, Jack, give him a fair go. At least hear what he's got to say, you know. And I find that if you treat people with respect, they'll treat you with respect back. So you've just got to do that, you know. Yes, we disagree, but let's try to forge something that's more important and inclusive.
Well, I think the takeaways from today are have more fun and thank you, Jeremy Bentham. Have more sex.
Yes, that's right.
Tim Flannery, thank you so much for joining us today on your whirlwind schedule. Thank you for coming out. Thank you, RMIT, the City of Melbourne, for Now or Never. It's been wonderful chatting. Thank you.
Thanks, Hilary. It's been fantastic.
Scientist Tim Flannery has another book coming out with his daughter in June called A Brief History of Climate Folly. amongst his many other books, of course, there is The Weathermakers, The Future Eaters, Atmosphere of Hope, and his hit Weird, Wild, Amazing series for kids. And thanks to my colleague Hilary Harper for hosting today's event, and to the Now or Never Festival in Naarm, Melbourne, for putting on the shebang with RMIT University, where Tim is Professor of Practice. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can email us at bigideas@abc.net.au. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.